You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we hear from a local advocate working to help Black girls and women who have been victims of sexual abuse heal and reclaim their bodies and lives after trauma.
Now, as COVID-19 cases surge in Wisconsin, other Midwestern states have seen their own surges in the last few weeks.
Illinois' governor has said they may have no choice but to impose a mandatory stay-at-home order.
And in Minnesota, there are new limitations on indoor gatherings and bar closing times going into effect today.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends or family in a neighboring state? What are you hearing from them? Have any of them changed how they think about or fear the spread of the coronavirus? And are you a healthcare professional? What has your experience been like these last few weeks? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Lauren Weber joins us now for a look at where things are at in the region around Wisconsin and what different states are trying to do to contain the spread of the virus. Lauren is Midwestern correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we know, as we just heard in the news, numbers are moving in the wrong direction here in Wisconsin. We keep breaking records that we don't want to break. How are things looking in the rest of the region?
If you look at Wisconsin, your guys' seven-day average for new COVID-19 cases, it's now surpassed New York City at the height of their dramatic spring outbreak, and it continues to surge at an alarming rate. So I would say things are not very good when you look at Wisconsin as a whole, but your surrounding states around you are not faring much better, a little bit better, but not much better. I will say what they have going for them that you may not is that a lot of the orders put in place by the Wisconsin governor have been overturned, whereas in some of the surrounding states, they've had better luck keeping them. But then again, you also have Iowa, which still does not have a complete mask mandate. So it obviously varies very much from state to state.
Can you talk a little more about the kind of measures we've seen in neighboring states that came into effect and stayed in effect, unlike in Wisconsin, where, as you mentioned, they were most of them overturned in courts or in the court process right now?
Absolutely. If you look at Illinois, they had much better luck with stay-at-home orders, right? They, obviously faced some sort of backlash, but it was not nearly the overturn that you're looking at. And you're seeing Chicago already kind of re-go back into some sort of lockdown as we kind of proceed through this week. And I anticipate more of that coming. And, at the bottom line is you have kind of what ends up happening is you have these blue states and you have these red states and how the different legislators respond to that. But like I said, if you look at Iowa, they never even had a mask mandate. And some other Midwest states like Missouri, which is actually where I'm calling in from, also does not have a mask mandate. You guys do have a mask mandate in place at least through November 21st, but even that has certainly been challenged, and we'll see what happens with it going forward.
Now, we heard our Governor Evers address the state just the other day. He didn't announce any new mandates, but he made a very strong plea for people to wear the masks, to do the social distancing. I want to give a listen now to governors from the states who are our neighbors. We'll hear in order here Governors Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan, J.B. Pritzker from Illinois, Kim Reynolds from Iowa, and Tim Walz from Minnesota.
We need people to individually do their part so collectively we get through this winter. We don't overwhelm our hospital systems, and we don't lose more lives. That's really, I think, the most important thing that we want to convey today is that the trajectory that we are on is dire, and it is very serious.
With many community leaders choosing not to listen to the doctors, we are left with not many tools left in our toolbox to fight this. The numbers don't lie. If things don't take a turn in the coming days, we will quickly reach the point when some form of a mandatory stay-at-home order is all that will be left.
COVID-19 does not discriminate based on geography. The virus is present in all of our communities, and all of us can help stop its spread.
We need to move now. This has happened incredibly quickly. You saw the stories of hospital systems around us that are already overwhelmed. We are still in a position to be able to handle this. There is going to be a lag time. This is the wave already breaking on the shore. What we're able to do is to shore up a little bit to push back after this one breaks for the next one that will come.
the governors of Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, respectively, there. Lauren, we're hearing that message of urgency now from more consistently, it seems like, from more governors in these states and others, aren't we?
Absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting you bring up Governor Whitmer. She also, similar to you all, has faced substantial pushback on some of the orders that she's put into place. And you're seeing the numbers rise in her state as well. But, you know, across the country, I would say all of the governors are urging, you know, responsibility, stay at home if you can. It's just the teeth that they have to enforce those kind of measures very much, what you know, varies widely from state to state.
Talking to Lauren Weber, Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News, looking at how COVID-19 is affecting the Midwest as a region, how Wisconsin compares to our neighbors and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your community, whether you're one of our listeners in Wisconsin or our neighbors? And if you work in healthcare anywhere in the region, I'd like to hear from you as well and what you are seeing at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lauren, big parts of all these states are rural. This is a disease that's hitting rural areas now, raising concerns about hospitals in those areas. You've been reporting on things, the story of not having supplies in some of the smaller healthcare facilities, senior facilities, other places. What kind of things are we seeing out there?
So unfortunately, you know, we've heard the story about how personal protective equipment or PPE has been short throughout this entire pandemic. I will say that as the demand has surged, supply has increased and a lot of hospitals have started to stockpile. But more rural areas, which Wisconsin has a lot of and a lot of Midwestern places have a lot of, you know, are having a harder time getting a hold of these supplies. When there's such a scramble for them, they, you know, they usually go up in price and your local rural health clinic or your local nursing home can't compete with these massive hospital chains that are able to buy at scale. And so you're left with rural health clinics being unable to get any gloves or, you know, your nursing home down the street not having any gowns. And that's the kind of thing that leads to more community spread, because when you don't really have a national allocation of these products to all the people that need it, you're going to end up having outbreaks in high-risk places that exacerbate the community spread throughout.
Now, absent that kind of federal coordination to get supplies where they're needed, are we seeing, I don't know, regional cooperation among states to try to get this sort of thing sorted out? Or is it everyone for themselves still at this point?
You know, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, we saw more of that regional cooperation. Right now, the PPE at the hospitals isn't at a dire point. So I don't think that they've had to really re-up those alliances to that effect. But as I said, you know, it's great that the hospitals have more PPE and seem to have some stockpiles. But frankly, if your nursing home and your local nursing home doesn't have PPE, those patients end up in the hospital. So it's kind of an unfortunate cycle in which these smaller providers are being priced out on the market and then, you know, potentially leading to more exposures and more folks ending up in the hospital after all.
How about testing capacity? What are you seeing? We're seeing in Wisconsin, one healthcare provider saying that they have to stop a lot of their public testing so they can pull that staff in to treat the people who they're treating with COVID as the hospitals fill up. How are we doing on testing now?
I mean, I think you hit on a really dire point inside the testing point, which is staffing, right? So first off, testing in general, just to look at that as a bucket, when you have just a tremendous surge of people looking to get tested and positivity rates going through the roof, you just have more people waiting in line. And our testing absolutely has improved from the spring. But when you have a crush of people all at once, you're going to get backlogged. And you also worry about, with this crush of people, you know, the things you need, swabs, reagents, all of that, you worry about that going short as well. But staffing is something you mentioned, and that's something I really want to stress is a huge problem in hospitals all across Wisconsin and frankly all across the Midwest, which is just getting slammed with COVID right now. You know, staffers like you or me, they also are exposed to COVID in the community or COVID while they're working. And if they have to quarantine for, you know, 2 weeks or are taken out by those exposures, you really can get limited on how much staff you have very quickly. And unlike New York City, Wisconsin obviously has a lot of healthcare facilities that are spread out in more rural areas and city areas. And they, you know, they do not have the just the sheer numbers of medical staff that other places do. And so you're seeing, especially in these rural communities, a fight for nurses who have to stay home with their sick kid who has been infected at school, or for staff that have been infected themselves and are very sick. I mean, these are the people that you need to keep us healthy, and even they are being affected by this virus. And so it just goes to show COVID-19 does not happen in a vacuum, and the effects of it continuing to ramp up in a potentially uncontrolled manner are huge.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hey, you hit on some of the points I was going to mention, but my wife's a critical care nurse at a major hospital in Eau Claire, and I'm a sales, so I think I got a pretty good handle on some of the stuff that's going on here. But there's a lot of things that the average people, the public, they don't think about. I'm amazed when I go out to a store how many people I still see walking around with no mask on. You can hear me okay, right?
Yep, keep going.
Yep. And so the one thing is my wife's critical care unit is 26 beds. Tuesday night, the last day she worked, 10 of those beds were occupied by COVID with 8 on a ventilator. The med-surg floor has about 40 COVID patients on it, 40, you know, that don't need a ventilator but that are sick enough. And, you know, you hit on the one nail on the head, that the more people hospitalized, the more workers get exposed to it. And I think within the Mayo system in Wisconsin right now, there's close to 300 healthcare workers that are out sick because either having the virus.
We just lost you, John. You're cutting in and out, John, but I think we get the gist. He's giving some firsthand information from his wife there, Lauren, of a system that's on the verge of being overwhelmed, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I just want to also reiterate, it's not like healthcare workers are impervious to this disease themselves. I mean, we've lost at least over 1,300 of them through the course of this pandemic, which is just horrific. I mean, these are people on the front lines, you know, attempting to save people like you or me if we are on a ventilator or if we are sick. And the fact that we're losing so many of them, either from lack of PPE or other exposure, is just incredibly distressing. And I, you know, I hope for that caller that his wife stays safe and that he stays safe. And I, you know, we all appreciate her work on the front lines in that regard.
Thanks for calling in. We're talking to Lauren Weber of Kaiser Health News about the surge in COVID-19 cases, big time here in Wisconsin, but elsewhere in the Midwest as well.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What should governors be doing in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states? Is the support for actions like that any different given the severity of cases now, or given the results of the presidential election? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Lauren Weber, Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We're looking at the impact of COVID-19 around the Midwest.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing people change their behavior in your community, whether you're here in Wisconsin or beyond? If you work in healthcare, interested in hearing your experience, what you're seeing right now at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I have family who are healthcare professionals who are on the front lines. And as your guest said, they are more at risk than anybody else. Right now, some frontline workers are wearing the same single-use N95s for up to a week at a time. A few months ago, my particular family member had worn her single-use N95 for 53 days. And still we have no action coming from the Wisconsin legislature besides trying to block a mask mandate. Robin Voss recently posted that he was interested in talking to the governor about it, but we're not seeing any kind of response, either nationally or statewide, except for what Governor Evers is trying to do unilaterally.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Lauren, that the story of reusing PPE still an issue out there for some healthcare workers?
Absolutely. I mean, I muttered this while he was speaking, but oh my gosh, 53 days. I mean, that is not what you want to see, and that's not the kind of thing that you're looking for when you're hoping to safely care or be cared for yourself and protected against this. That's obviously way too long to have an N95 mask. And I, you know, that's horrifying to hear. And I think, you know, as people are trying to conserve PPE, which is once again expensive because it's in high demand, you see measures like that put into place, but that very much puts people at risk. And it's just such a shame. Honestly, you feel like you're living in Alice in Wonderland. These are all the same problems and all the same stories that have happened in different parts of the country as, you know, the months have gone on of this pandemic. And yet here we are again, you know, new state, same problems. And it's just horrifying.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Sarah with us now in Lodi. Sarah, hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. What do you got to say, Sarah?
Well, I'm a retired nurse. And I don't know that people realize how at risk teachers, medical care, medical workers, my daughter's a social worker in child protective services. They can't stop seeing people in their home when kids are at risk. But in ICUs, those staff members are exposed to huge viral load because they're suctioning trachs. They're not just bathing people, the care of people on a ventilator is huge. And I think, you know, if you don't want to wear a mask, I understand, but you need to step up and just do it. It's not, we have to start respecting what people do to take care of us when we're sick.
Sarah, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about how much more exposure, especially working around someone on a ventilator, might be. And making the case, Sarah, is for wearing the mask to help them out, Lauren.
Yeah, and I'll just add, too, I mean, the science has shown that wearing a mask, you know, not only could save someone else from COVID, but could save you from worse effects of COVID. Because if you're wearing a mask or face covering, you're less likely to inhale as many, you know, droplets of COVID-19 or of the virus that carries, you know, that has the virus. And your case could then be less severe. So not only are you helping other people by wearing a mask, but you also potentially are saving yourself from a worse case of it.
Thanks for sharing your experience there with that call. We'll go to Steve now, calling here in Wisconsin. Steve, hello.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Steve.
Oh, yes. Well, I just am curious. I haven't heard too much about anything about the suicidal rate going up, and I'm a mental health specialist, or I was. I'm retired. I'm 75 years old, a Vietnam combat veteran, and I'm used to people taking their own lives at times. And so I'm curious how high has the suicide rate climbed since this virus took over?
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And I've seen, before I throw this to you, Lauren, I've seen just information out today that we kind of don't know. There's been some viral social media posts saying it's up, some research saying it's inconclusive at this point. But, Lauren, I think it's not controversial to say there is a serious mental health challenge going on with the extra stress from the coronavirus. What are we seeing when it comes to mental health care?
Rob, that's a great point. I was going to add in, you know, it's interesting. I looked into this at the beginning of the pandemic, and even now to this day, we just don't have the stats on it to really adequately answer that question. But I will say that, you know, one concern I have in covering the public health system, and I'm sure you know this as someone that's worked in mental health, is that in general, mental health services are not very well funded. And if you combine COVID-19, where public health officials are being pulled into pandemic response all the time, you know, you worry that you're losing health folks that would be working on mental health or expanding those resources you're losing that to budget cuts that are being cut because of tax shortfalls, or you're losing those people because they're getting pulled on to COVID-19 call hotlines. And so, you know, very much this is a big concern. And, you know, I would urge, you know, listeners to absolutely reach out to people that they think are struggling, you know, because mental health is a concern without a pandemic involved.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. In our last couple of minutes, Lauren, I want to look to the future. We've got some promising news about vaccines, hopefully in the not too distant horizon. But between now and then, cases going up, and we know, sadly, hospitalizations and deaths tend to follow over the couple of weeks after cases go up. What are you watching for to see how this goes in the Midwestern region?
I mean, I think, sadly, we're in for a lot of pain over the next couple of weeks. I mean, I think, you know, what we're going to see is cases continue to go up until behavior really dramatically changes. And as of right now, there's really nothing in place to make folks in Wisconsin dramatically change their behavior from an enforcement, you know, point of view. And I will also say something that we haven't talked about. You know, I've written pretty extensively about how local public health officials, so many of them have resigned, been fired, or retired since the beginning of this pandemic. And actually in Wisconsin, I checked our database between Kaiser Health News and the Associated Press, and 9 of them, which is a higher than usual turnover, have resigned, retired, or been fired since the beginning of the pandemic. And a lot of that is because they've seen pushback from their local community. You know, in the absence of more federal leadership and guidance, you know, it often falls on your local health official to really be the punching bag for people when it comes to, you know, what should be done, you know, isolation, quarantine, shutdowns, and so on. And it's very difficult for these people to be on a different kind of front line. And you've lost quite a few of them in Wisconsin.
Lauren, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Weber is Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We've been talking to her about the big increases in coronavirus, not just in Wisconsin, but all over the Midwest. Coming up, we'll hear from a local advocate for the safety and healing of Black girls and women. She'll tell us about her podcast and work, Defending Black Girls. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the pandemic has made it hard to stay in touch with people, but there are ways. We'll check out Quarantine Connections, a project that's bringing people together by mail, one letter at a time.
Now, our next guest has made it her mission to be a voice and advocate for Black girls and women who have experienced sexual abuse and trauma.
After writing a book about her own experiences of sexual abuse and healing called I Can't Live Like This Anymore, Laleda G., founded Defending Black Girlhood, a Madison-based nonprofit organization that inspires Black women to join her in her life's work to defend Black girlhood by creating safe places for Black girls to heal.
Here's a listen to a bit of her podcast, Defending Black Girlhood, that features Laleda G and her producer, Alexandra, and creative director, Cassandra.
I am sick and tired. And I didn't just get sick and tired. I've been sick and tired of being sick and tired for 400 years.
The depths of healing and being able to get into those tough moments, but also the joyful moments of healing. I think we talk a lot about the traumatic, the hard, the difficult, but there's also self-reflection that's absolutely necessary for us as Black women to survive and to keep living on this in this world.
Laleda G is with us right now. Laleda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you talk about what you thought was missing in the world that inspired you to create the organization Defending Black Girlhood?
The defense of Black girls has been missing. You know, in 1962, the Honorable Malcolm X had a profound comment that the most disrespected person in America was the Black woman. And though I agree with that, I go deeper to say if the Black woman is disrespected, then so is the black girl. And the black girl has a lot less power to do anything about it.
And is it that issue of power that that made you name the podcast, the organization, Defending Black Girlhood? Is that the element why you believe black girls and women need that extra protection?
That's part of it. But the other part is that I want people to understand what we need to do, and what we are about doing is defending. Like, we are in that action, and we need others to join us in that action, so that it, people understand that it is something that an action must be taken in order to do it, not just happy thoughts, not just good wishes.
What do you think is not understood about the challenges and the threats that black girls and women face?
I think it's less of an understanding and more of apathy. I think what we don't have is the heart that goes towards black girls who become black women and carry the scars from their girlhood as well as historical trauma with them. And so I think our hearts are not turned to black girls. You know, when we look at the estimated 65,000 black girls and women who are missing right now, and that's only on reported numbers, you know, that's larger than most towns and cities in the state of Wisconsin. And there's not an alarm. You know, when one white girl goes missing, the world stops. There's 65,000 missing, and we're just going on. And so I think the issues that are impacting our black girls, we have to turn our hearts towards them.
Talk a little bit more about that, Lalaita, that not only is that obviously a tragedy and a travesty for those 65,000 missing black girls and women, but what message, as you were just saying about how a white girl in danger is treated versus a black girl, what message does that send to other black girls and women?
It shows that the message is that you're not valuable, that you're not important. Not only can one of you go missing, but 60 plus thousand of you can go missing, and the world goes on. And I think that we have to understand that if we have a crisis of black girls that impacts all of us, that the value that they bring to schools, to families, to communities, that when they're gone, it matters. And when we don't even go looking for them, when we don't ring the alarm bell, then it just gives them the message, it doesn't even matter that you were here, and it doesn't matter that you're not any longer.
That actually was the topic of the first season of the podcast, which is also called Defending Black Girlhood. And it focused on those missing black women and girls. You've now started the next season. What are your plans for this next installment?
Great question. Yeah, the first season was very intense when we took the whole season to talk about Erica Hill, who was a black girl who was missing from our Madison community for 12 years, and the police were never called to look for her. And so we went very in depth with that. This second season, we're going to be hitting a number of topics, talking with local women, national women, about issues that impact defending black girlhood. And so the season started off with another young black girl from our community, Aprina Paul, who was missing, and subsequently we discovered that she was murdered. We had an in-depth conversation with her mother.
And you also spent time talking to Alice LaRue in this new season, who lost her daughter in 2013 and has now made it her mission to talk about and bring to the surface sex trafficking. Let's take a listen to her talking about her experience.
I was angry for a long time. Then I let that anger go and forgave her. Mm-hmm. And I told her, I forgive you. That's when I started seeing her.
Wow.
I can remember the first time when I said, I forgive you. I'm sorry. I just had this talk because I had to let it go. I was making myself sick holding all this anger in. Yeah. You know, it wasn't doing me no good doing it. So once I did forgive her, I can remember the first time she came to me. I was sitting on the side of my bed, and I'm a dream, of course.
Yeah.
And she's at the window, and she said, Mom, I'm sorry. Can I come in?
Oh, my God.
And she came in. We talked, and she said, I'll be back. That's when I woke up.
Very, very powerful there, wow. Lolita. Why is it so important for you to take these stories to greater, very raw emotional depths like that?
I need people to feel the pain of Black girls. I need people to feel the pain of Black women and understand it, be touched by it, because I think as much as we try to deal with social justice and racism in our country, to me, the core is having love. And I think when we can feel each other's pain, then we can't help but respond in some kind of way. And I think it's also important for us to tell our story, for us to have voice. And I think that's having voice is as important as being heard.
We're talking with Lolita G right now. She's the founder of Defending Black Girlhood. It's a Madison-based nonprofit organization that inspires Black women to join her in her life's work to defend Black girlhood. She also hosts a podcast of the same name. And Lolita, your podcast and the organization Center on Healing. What are some of the ways in which you see healing taking place and that you really want to advocate for and help support?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that I have come to deeply understand in my work is that when Black women don't heal, Black girls are left undefended. And so as we help Black women to heal, to deal with their personal trauma, to deal with their historical trauma, they are in better positions to be able to themselves defend their Black girls, to also advocate for their Black girls in the school system, the social services within the community. And so that healing is so much at the core. And sometimes it means that we are working to heal the Black girl within Black women who never got a chance to heal.
It is incredibly difficult to talk about trauma and to bring those experiences to the surface, to share them with other people. In your experience, Lolita, how do you talk about trauma and what are the rewards in getting past that hurdle?
Yes. And so trauma is tricky because it's like the pulling off of the bandage, right? And so when we begin to enter into conversations, I've led countless groups of girls, of women, over the past 30 years, and everyone is kind of suspect and afraid and ashamed as we begin to have these healing conversations. But as we begin to share, and as we share the hidden parts of our lives, and then somebody else says, yes, that happened to me, or I understand that, suddenly you are no longer in the darkness by yourself. When you've gone through a traumatic experience, when you've gone through an abusive experience, usually that darkness stays between you and the person who victimized you. When you begin to heal and have these conversations and have this bridges of community with other women, what ends up happening is you are no longer in that darkness with that person. Light comes in. And when the light comes in, you're able to alleviate a lot of the shame that you have. And so that's this part of it. It's like, first is having the courage, and it takes an extreme amount of courage to heal, to begin a healing journey. But once you do, you find out you're not alone and there's others that can walk with you through this journey.
Lolita, before we let you go, I'd like to ask you, how can other people, regardless of gender, race, background, experience, promote this kind of healing and really support and recognize the work of Black woman-led efforts like this?
Absolutely. One, we have to know that we need to believe Black women and hear Black women, that we know what's best for ourselves and for our girls and our families. And then the second thing is seeing what role do we play, because we are either promoting defense of Black girls or we're hindering it. There's no in between.
Lolita, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lolita G is the founder of Defending Black Girlhood, a Madison-based nonprofit organization that inspires Black women to join her in her life's work to defend Black girlhood by creating safe spaces for Black girls and women to heal. She also hosts the podcast of the same name, Defending Black Girlhood.
Find out how you can get a pen pal to write thanks to a new project created by a team of artists, including a UW-Milwaukee professor. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up Monday at this time, join us for Mondays with Mike with the latest news from behind the scenes at Wisconsin Public Radio. That's Monday at 4:30 on the Ideas Network.
Now, connecting with other people over the last few months has been challenging, at least in person, but we've come up with some modern solutions like online gatherings.
And the creators of a project called Quarantine Connections are helping connect strangers through a different form of communication, writing letters. Two of the project's creators join us now.
Scott Kildall is a new media artist and educator based in San Francisco. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Great, thank you.
And Nathaniel Stern is an artist and writer. He's professor of art and mechanical engineering at UW-Milwaukee. Nathaniel, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Well, you both and your other collaborator have interests overlapping in art and technology. Nathaniel, how did you all land up on creating this project that involves the old school art of handwritten letters?
Yeah, so Chris Butson, Scott Kildall, and I, Chris being our other collaborator who's based in Montreal and is a UW-Milwaukee alum, we've got a history of working with networked art. You know, we've used technologies like Twitter and Wikipedia to connect people and think differently about how they relate to technology. And when we hit quarantine and the pandemic, what we felt people were really missing was a physical connection, a tangible way to feel presence. And so we thought, how can we use technology and the internet to rather create a socially distanced method of literally making contact, touching one another? And letter writing was the kind of best solution we could come to there.
And Scott, talk us through how it works. How do we sign up for Quarantine Connections and get connected with someone to write a letter to?
Sure. Well, the first thing you do is you go to the Quarantine Connections website, which is simply quarantineconnections.org. And you sign up on the website, and you have to do it through Facebook. We want to make sure that people are safe and there's some level of accountability, because the idea is that you're connecting strangers, so people that don't know each other whatsoever. And so you go on to the site there, and then you can sign up to be either a letter writer or a letter receiver, because some people want to write and some people feel like they need to receive.
And Nathaniel, I think I saw a suggestion. Let's steer clear of more controversial topics, politics and religion. This is more about connecting on a personal level, right?
Exactly that. Yeah. We asked people that you can include anything that fits in an envelope. So we've had people include recipes and stickers and pictures. But the idea here is, especially in the current age of polarization, we want people to feel connected without having to worry about any kind of political drive. And that's not to say that that's not in our hearts and minds and relating to our everyday, but we want this to be a platform that is able to circumvent that and connect without having to worry which party line you might stand on, for example.
Scott, what kind of things have you heard from people who have participated and what they've gotten out of writing and or receiving these letters?
Well, the letter writers have been taking their task very seriously, I should say, and with a lot of humor at the same time. So what I mean seriously is they don't just write some sort of glib note, but they end up writing down what they've been doing, including stickers, recipes, and really kind of padding up that envelope as much as possible, because they realize that the person who's asking for a letter could be anyone, and that person, what they really want to have is some sort of sense of a smile or a connection to a total stranger and realize, like Nathaniel said, regardless of politics or religion, that we are all human beings who have and share some sort of deep connection with each other. And that's what I think we want more than anything in this especially polarizing and troubling time and under a quarantine and this terrible pandemic that's going on.
That's interesting, Nathaniel. If I sign up to be a letter writer, I get the name of the person I'm writing to. I don't necessarily know anything about them. Is that right?
So what we try to do is respect people's privacy, but also make sure that there's a common interest. So If you say you're willing to be a writer, then you get put in a queue of people that are potential writers. And then if you sign up to be a letter receiver, you actually will see an option of five different people. And you'll see a bio that they've given you,
where you could see what some of their interests are or why they're on the site. And then if you select them as your letter writer, you only have ever seen that bio. You don't get their address. And then if you're selected to write a letter, you'll see just an address, but not any of their Facebook information. And what's great here is, in addition to kind of choosing someone based on your bio, your writer then gets a bio and a few prompts. So we'll ask on the site, what do you want to hear about? And then someone can say, tell me about the weather, or tell me what you've done for fun, or tell me a recent film you watched, or a book. And that way it gives you a little prompt to get started on someone that you haven't met and don't know. We've both participated in the site. One of our most avid users is actually my mother-in-law, who's based here in River West in Milwaukee. And I've seen pictures. She's sent 5, 10, 15-page letters to people before. Hi, Susie.
We're talking to Nathaniel Stern and Scott Kildall, two of the creators of Quarantine Connections, this special way to reach out and write a letter or two or receive a letter from a stranger. Scott, are people picking up correspondences? Has this just been one-off, or are people saying, hey, yeah, I want to write back to this person who sent me a letter?
Well, you know, and the answer to that is I don't really know. As the creator of the project, I'm not sure where people are going with it. But one thing we really want to do is create a no-obligation situation. So if you're the person who's receiving a letter, of course you have the letter writer's address, and you can send something back, but you don't have to. And so I think creating that sense of no strings attached, like there's just a letter coming your way, you may not get something back, creates that that opportunity so that people can have a correspondence. And I do know of one case through mutual friends who told me later on they've been talking. So at least one set of people have been doing this.
Now, Nathaniel, I want to talk about the art side of this. You are all artists. What is it like to create this thing that you, as Scott was saying, you don't really know what's going to end up happening with it and what the content of the art you've created is ultimately going to be?
I think the connections themselves are something that we're really proud of. All three of us have done work in the past where we're more over setting the stage and facilitating different kinds of relationships. And I think in the modern and contemporary space of art, that's what most of it does. Nicolas Bourriaud, who wrote Relational Aesthetics, talks about how the work of any work of art in this day and age is actually the conversations that happen in front of it in a gallery and the relations that can grow from how you discuss and dialogue around it. And so for us, we're just taking that a step further and amplifying the relationships themselves.
Scott, is this plan to go on indefinitely, or is it until the pandemic's over? So it's actually a project you're hoping will end sooner rather than later?
Yeah, that's the irony of it, is that all art has a shelf life, right? And and so in this case, it would be better if the project died because we'd be out of quarantine in some ways. However, the idea of creating this connection across spaces, like Nathaniel says, like art is about the relations involved oftentimes rather than the object, is something that I hope that people will pick up post-pandemic and say, like, wait, this has been a successful project and we want to go ahead and keep on doing this. And perhaps there's going to be quarantines of different natures in the future. Maybe psychologically people feel quarantined, they feel stuck. And this project will address that in a broader sense, which is why we don't call it, you know, COVID connections or really label it to this specific pandemic.
And Nathaniel, as we start to wrap up, can you talk about why letter writing in particular? You could have done it, I guess, as emails or phone calls or any number of other ways of communicating.
Yeah, and we thought those through. And really for us, it was about that physical connection. There's something exciting, even still, of getting something in the mail. And now we order more and more things online because of quarantine. But there's nothing like getting a handwritten note and sending and receiving that, and then being able to make that physical connection. It means a lot to us. We love receiving letters, and so that's part of why we went in that direction.
Well, Nathaniel, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Scott, thanks for being with us.
Great. Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Scott Kildall, new media artist based in San Francisco, and Nathaniel Stern, an artist and a professor of art and mechanical engineering at UW-Milwaukee, talking about this project, quarantineconnections.org. They're two of the creators of the project. You can sign up to write a letter at quarantineconnections.org, or we've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7:30, Kate welcomes the state's top medical official for a look at the latest COVID-19 trends and a plea for Wisconsin residents to be careful. That's Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a psychologist about resilience and how we can adopt a resilience mindset to cope with stress and uncertainty. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.